I'm here every Saturday at this time, and had a pretty interesting bunch of guests in the past several weeks, and we're going to have one of the most interesting yet tonight, one of America's leading theologians, a man who's been a big influence on David Griffin in his overall history of thought, philosophy, and theology, a man who has contributed mightily to the new book that I co-edited with him, and Sandra Lubarsky. It's called 9/11 in the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. Our guest tonight is John Cobb, the eminent theologian and founder of Process Theology. I don't know if he's on the line yet, but let's try him. John, are you there yet? Guess not. Well, we're still trying to reach him. So let me tell you a little bit about him. John Cobb is a professor emeritus of at the Claremont School of Theology, the same place that David Griffin taught. John is the founding director of the Center for Process Studies, the co-founder of Progressive Christians Uniting, and the editor of Progressive Christians Speak. He's an ordained minister with the United Methodist Church. He has written a long list of books, which I won't rattle off because it would take up a big chunk of the show. His books include The Liberation of Life, with Charles Birch, For the Common Good with Herman Daly, Christ in a Pluralistic Age, Postmodernism and Public Policy, and most recently he's joined with David Griffin and Richard Falk, member of the Nation's editorial board, and Catherine Keller, a fellow theologian, to co-produce The American Empire and the Commonwealth of God, a book which addresses some of the 9/11 questions that we're concerned with here. So, I hope we'll have John on the line when we come back, or shortly thereafter, and we'll have an interesting conversation. So, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I
Yeah, I found out, too. I found out 2 years after 9/11 that it looked to be an inside job, and that put me on a very interesting path that led me to encounters with some fascinating people, beginning with David Griffin, the guy who I'd first heard about this from, and leading to tonight's guest, John Cobb. It so happens that John Cobb and David Griffin are the two biggest names in process theology, one of the most alive and intellectual schools of Christian theology today. He's pretty much a household name among theologians, and I'm told that John is on the line. Come on in, John. How are you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm doing fine. It's good to finally hear your voice after corresponding on email for so long.
Okay, then I guess I know who I'm speaking to.
Yeah, this is Kevin Barrett, your co-editor of 9/11 and the American Empire,
yes.
Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, our book, which should be out in 2-3 weeks, I guess.
Well, that's great.
It is good news. So, John, I thought I'd start out tonight's show by asking you a little bit about how your association with David Griffin led to your awakening to the controversies around 9/11.
Well, of course, David is a close friend. We were colleagues on the faculty. Once upon a time, I was his professor, and we worked together in the Center for Process Studies, so I keep up with what he does. And when he began to investigate these matters, I, of course, wanted to know what was happening. So he has brought me along with him. I've not done any independent investigation, so I'm very much dependent on what I've learned from him.
Yes, I think quite a few people are. I know I was one of the many people who was kind of skeptical about some of the 9/11 revisionist ideas that came out during the first couple of years. And in my case, it wasn't until I heard that David was writing the new Pearl Harbor and what his thesis was that I decided to take the time to look into it carefully. Yep. And so I guess he dragged me into it, too.
Well, I think once you got in it, you took the bit in your mouth and had given great leadership.
Well, thank you. I'm trying. I don't know if leadership is quite the right word for this movement, though. I think it's kind of a leaderless resistance movement. A bunch, you know, it's a group of anarchists who have to work together and sometimes have a hard time doing it.
I'm sure that's true. My actual activity, apart from occasionally writing things and bringing the topic up in places it might not other come, teaching Sunday school classes occasionally and things like that, is simply to try to keep up with what other people are writing. And my commitment is, I think, the commitment of a good many of us who are in this situation, that we need the truth, and we won't get the truth until there is an investigation that is not hamstrung by those who are themselves involved in making 9/11 happen.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that, and I've been trying to convince some of my colleagues in the 9/11 truth movement that working for an independent investigation that would get at the truth is more productive than bickering about technical details about what might have happened. That's taken up a fair bit of my time recently. But, John, I noticed that you made some really interesting contributions to this new book, The American Empire and the Commonwealth of God,
yes.
A Political, Economic, and Religious Statement, along with David Griffin, Richard Falk, and Catherine Keller. And I wondered if your contribution to this book, which is a critique of the American Empire, which has gone into overdrive since 9/11, is that something that you've been involved with before, or did you like David Griffin, get interested in studying the history of the U.S. Empire because of 9/11?
Well, my interest over the many years has been in the global economy. I think economic globalization has done terrible harm and is leading us to the brink of disaster environmentally and socially and in many other ways. So there is a connection between the neocolonialism of the global economy and empire. However, I had been so inclined to think that economics was the all-determinative motivation in governmental action that it came as something of a surprise to me to find that the neoconservatives, though of course influenced by economic considerations, had a very strong nationalistic and imperialistic ideology. That I had learned only recently. I learned it from their documents. So 9/11 simply fitted into that kind of pattern rather than being the reason I got interested in it.
That's right. Yes, the question of the neoconservatives and, you know, precisely what they believe and why they're doing what they're doing is an endlessly fascinating one for some of us. And I thought in your essay in our book that's coming out soon, 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, you provided a fairly charitable interpretation of the motivations of the neoconservatives. And I think that essay, which leads off our book, is something that really is, it's, I think it's an extraordinary work. I'm not sure I agree with it, but I think in terms of, you know, what it is, you really succeeded magnificently. And for those who haven't read it yet, which I imagine is all of our listeners since the book has been delayed and finally should be out in just a few weeks, let me just briefly summarize how you begin your argument by saying that as a theologian, you're not in a position to know what happened on 9/11 any more than anyone else is, but you are in a position to have something to say about the perpetrators, whoever they were, and their moral standing, I guess. And you begin by saying that if indeed it was Osama and the 19 young Arabs, that there would be actual motivations for these people to do it, and that they wouldn't necessarily be evil. And then you move on to say that if it was in fact an inside job led by neoconservatives, they wouldn't necessarily be evil either, because they believe that American empire is good for the world. And if a new Pearl Harbor, such as 9/11, were necessary to expand the empire, then they would have a rational and even somewhat benevolent motivation within their own framework of seeing things. I think that's a really interesting way to begin your essay.
Well, I've long been convinced that the greatest evils in the world are done by people who are not vicious. They have reasons for doing things, and they are probably, in a broad sense, good people. Unfortunately, virtue doesn't get us very far.
quite an outlook for a theologian.
Well, I think as a theologian, I think it's more important what we believe than it is how virtuous we are. I think a great many people who followed Hitler were people who did so because they thought it was the service of their nation, and that the service of their nation was a virtuous thing. If people weren't virtuous enough to sacrifice themselves for their nations, we could have avoided a lot of wars.
You know, I think you have a very good point. And there is a danger to carrying virtue too far. As far as the neoconservatives go, I've looked into them a little bit, and sometimes I wonder whether they actually make a virtue of vice. That is, that, you know, rather than genuinely believing that American empire is benevolent, you know, there's an interpretation of their philosophy that suggests that, you know, they go back to the Greeks and argue that you know, Socrates and Plato had this notion of the good, which they spoke about in public, but in private they had this secret philosophy that what's good for me is bad for you, and a tiny elite understands this and has not just the right but the duty to put it into practice by using the most foul means to achieve absolute dominion over everyone else and to rule over everyone through big lies and complete amorality. Is that an interpretation of the neoconservative philosophy that you've encountered? Or?
Well, yes, and it may be the case, but you see, even in your formulation, they felt they had the duty to do it. So they're still being virtuous in doing it. Mm-hmm. I have taken them more at face value in their claims that the world has to have a ruler, and that the U.S. is the most benevolent option for that kind of rule. But of course it may be that they don't really care what's good for anybody except themselves. I mean, that's not impossible.
And You disagree with their belief that the world has to have a ruler. I've noticed that you've advocated a certain kind of decentralization of power.
I think it's a terrible belief based upon very false notions. So my charity with respect to virtue has nothing to do with agreement with the ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear.
No, I simply think, they have engaged over a long period of time in very extensive intellectual exchange with each other, much of which is in public. I doubt that all of that is simply a front for something entirely different that they privately believe. So I'm inclined to give them, at least some of them, the benefit of the doubt that they, that in their realistic view of the world, it will always be dominated by somebody or other, and that a Pax Americana is the best prospect for all the countries of the world, or for the countries of the world together. Now, obviously, this coincides with the interests of the people who are going to be at the center of the Pax Americana. And I suspect that for a great many of us, our ideals and what's good for us tend to coalesce. In other words, our ideals get somewhat influenced, at least, by our own interests.
No, I think that's probably an understatement, John. We're hearing the theme music indicating...
You may have a stronger view of original sin than I do.
Well, I doubt that. We Muslims aren't supposed to believe in original sin. Well, we'll hash this out again after the break. You're listening to Truth Jihad Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett, interviewing theologian John Cobb. Stay with us. To remember to get back on the line and resume Truth Jihad Radio. This is Kevin Barrett, your host, and I'm speaking with the eminent Christian theologian John Cobb, contributor to 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, a book that should be in the bookstores somewhere between 2 or 3 weeks and maybe a month from now at the most. And I guess the next thing I wanted to ask you about, John, was your ideas about the situation for interfaith dialogue in this rather bizarre post 9/11 era of rapid fire American imperial expansion. Just today we had a very bizarre choice of days for the announcement that Saddam Hussein had been executed. This is the Eid al-Adha, the biggest holiday in the Muslim calendar, and it's a day to pardon people. It's a day to make up with people that you've had a problem with in the previous year. The idea of executing someone prominently and announcing it on Eid al-Adha, in this, you know, especially the leader of a mostly Muslim nation that you've invaded and destroyed, is just beyond belief to me. It's just like the choice of Ramadan, of the holiest night of Ramadan, the night of power, to destroy Fallujah. And I wonder, these people in charge of policy, are they waking up in the morning and asking themselves, what can we do today to piss the Muslims off?
Well, I'm fascinated by what you say, because I was completely unaware of it, which is an indication, of the business today being a special day of that kind. It's an indication of how badly we do need dialogue, so that at least those of us who would like to be sensitive to such matters could be. But do you think that the date was set then without the supposed government of Iraq having any role in it?
Well,
they know better?
You know, I can't believe that that nobody would know better. It's just, it's inconceivable. I mean, this is, you know, it's the Eid al-Adha is sort of the equivalent of, you know, sort of Christmas, Easter, and the 4th of July all rolled into one. And again, it's very well known that it's a day of atonement, and it celebrates God's sparing His Son. So it's a day celebrating mercy and all of that. And I just can't imagine that whoever is behind this execution, which is obviously the occupying power, wouldn't know this. And just as it's inconceivable that they wouldn't have known that, the night of power, which is the night that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, was the night that they chose to just start massacring everybody in Fallujah.
No, I understand the Fallujah thing. I just wasn't aware of the importance of this day today. Well, I simply can't imagine that. I mean, first, I couldn't imagine that this execution took place without some influence from the Iraqis. I'm not saying that they're in charge, but officially it was an Iraqi court.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of skeptical about that, John. I mean, what we hear over here is that there is, there's an Iraqi court and there's an Iraqi government. But, I think that there's a lot less of one than there was. The Vichy regime in occupied France was vastly more independent than what we have in Iraq. Before the invasion, from what I was hearing from on the ground, everybody, including the people who hated Saddam Hussein the most, people being interviewed by journalists who were able to communicate what was actually going on there, unanimous. I mean, the whole country was essentially unanimous that if there were an American invasion, we will die resisting it. And the Shiites in the south, the biggest enemies of Saddam, it was almost unanimous. And so, to the extent there's been this sort of Iraqi camouflage of a puppet regime, I mean, it doesn't fool anybody there or in most of the world. It only seems to be fooling the Americans.
But I'm just surprised that the Americans would not be interested in making it look like the Iraqi government was the one that was executing Saddam.
Well, I think they have tried to do that.
but putting it on this date seems a way of exactly making it clear that they were not letting anyone who knew anything about the situation play a role. And that's what is really startling to me. It seems so contrary to American interests.
Well, it depends what the interests are. I'm thinking that the real interests these days are to destabilize and destroy the periphery of the empire so as to extract their resources more efficiently. So that there's absolutely no effort to stabilize Iraq. In fact, most of the major terrorism there, I believe, has been carried out by the occupation forces and their allies, like the Mossad. The Golden Dome Mosque was blown up after the whole area was cordoned off by American troops and evacuated. And there are a number of other cases where we have fairly convincing evidence that some of the biggest incidents, these explosions in markets that kill 100 people plus, are actually being perpetrated by the occupiers in order to provoke a civil war and essentially to destroy the country, to make it, it was reaching a level of European standards of living in the past, and this invasion is just knocking it out as a regional power. Well, we'll come back and hash out this interfaith dialogue in the post-9/11 era thing after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. This is your host, Kevin Barrett, speaking with theologian John Cobb, my co-editor and fellow contributor to 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. It was quite an exercise of interfaith dialogue producing this book. I think the book stands as a really interesting compendium of what some leading intellectuals and a couple of not-so-leading intellectuals like me have to say about 9/11 and the American Empire. And I think John Cobb's essay, which leads the volume, is maybe the most strikingly concise and interesting of the submissions. It's a terrific piece, and I urge people to run out and buy the book so they can read it. So, John, we're talking about interfaith dialogue in a kind of a crazy post 9/11 era when Muslims are understandably paranoid, made so by things like this choice of the biggest holiday in the Muslim calendar for the execution of Saddam. Where do you see interfaith dialogue going in the future?
Well, I would say that one of the silver linings of this whole situation is that at least within the Christian community, interfaith dialogue in the past had been intensive with Jews because of our guilt about the Holocaust, and we've had lively interfaith dialogue with Buddhists and to a lesser extent with Hindus and others. I won't go through all the details, but there had been really very little with Muslims, and the beginning of that had been taking place before, but since 9/11 you can't publish anything that is supposed to be religiously diverse without Muslims playing a significant role. So in the circles in which I move, there has actually been a certain improvement in this respect. And I'm also, I think that I'm sure you're much more aware of it than I, but that many universities feel now that they must give attention to Islam in a way they had not before. And it's not all negative. I mean, I think there's a real effort to understand. So I hope that in spite of all the terrible features of what's going on, that this will be one that is a permanent part of our change. Locally, just in the town that I live, there is a mosque, but we had hardly paid any attention to it. It wasn't in the news. Nothing was happening. The week of 9/11, 1,000 people, mostly Christians, since it was mainly organized by the churches, went to the mosque to express their solidarity with the Muslim people who were there, and there have been serious efforts since. I don't think we're so unusual in that. I'm just trying to say the recognition that our ignorance of Islam and the prejudice against Islam, which certainly has been part of Christian culture in the West, were extremely dangerous, hit us hard right after 9/11.
Yes, I think you're right. There has been a sort of a silver lining in that sense. And Muslims definitely suddenly have the impression that others know we exist.
Yes.
Although, you know, whether it's the kind of attention we need is not always obvious.
A lot of it is negative, I know. But I think in much of the Christian community there is a favorable a positive response rather than a negative one. That's all I'm saying. No, I don't mean that life for Muslims has become easier in a Christian country as a result of 9/11. I'm sure that's exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I think you're right. I have been invited to give mini courses on Islam at some Christian churches here in South Central Wisconsin, and those have been good experiences.
I think they really wanted to hear it from, you know, in a positive way. They weren't trying to find ammunition against you or something like that.
That's true. Although, you know, there are these kinds of basic stereotypes. You know, the two big ones, which I think are related, are the stereotype of Muslim men oppressing women,
yes,
and the stereotype of Muslims being violent. And those two things kind of go together. It's a little bit like with black men, that this kind of almost sexualized fear of violence of this darker-skinned male other, which, you know, it's been a big part of U.S. history, mostly focused on African Americans.
Yes.
And some of that seems to be, you know, aimed at Muslims now, which I'm a little leery of all of that, just because, you know, of the kind of, you know, violence that's associated with it.
Well, you should be extremely leery of that. And you get those kinds of questions or challenges when you go to these churches, is partly what you're saying.
Right. And the
but
one
if
thing
they will bring it out and ask you and give you a chance to respond, that's healthy.
It's true. And overall, it's been good. And it's been kind of frustrating trying to take the 9/11 truth case to some of these people who are quite willing to hear about Islam. But if
well,
I say
yes. Yes, I think that there is enormous resistance to the notion that our government could do things like that to us.
There certainly is, and you know, and it's really maddening to me, especially you know, since after having looked at the footage of the World Trade Center being demolished, which is what it is, you know, Building 7 is coming down in a classic controlled demolition with the crimp in the roof and free fall speed, and the landlord confessing and collecting $4 billion insurance money on you know, six-week investment. And then the Twin Towers are just obviously being, as Morgan Reynolds puts it, blown to kingdom come. There's just, I don't understand how anybody, you know, any eight-year-old with an elementary sense of physics who looks at these buildings exploding into shards and powder and, you know, with huge steel chunks being blown hundreds of feet up to 500-600 feet upwards and outwards. I mean, how can anybody see this as a gravity-driven collapse? And, you know, so there's a part of my mind that says, you know, how could anyone, you know, look at this more than once or twice and not understand? And then I'm faced with the reality of people not understanding. And it's a very strange kind of, you know, way to live in a society of people who are, you know, see things so differently from the way I do.
No, I think that and probably church people on average would be even more resistant to the theories about 9/11 than other people. I'm not sure of that. I mean, this is simply a guess that they inclined to be people who don't want to believe the worst, and especially not of their own government. And there's this sense that the United States is a Christian nation, and obviously a government of a Christian nation couldn't do that kind of thing to us. So it's probably even worse in the churches than it is elsewhere.
Yes, it is. I feel like I'm kind of swimming upstream, but we're still working on it at the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. That's MUJCA.com. And we're hoping to take that organization to the next level this year. We're obtaining a professional-style DVD burner so we can churn out, you know, 100 a day. And our goal is to get a copy of David Griffin's talk, 9/11 in the American Empire, How Should Religious People Respond, into the mailboxes of every church, synagogue, and mosque in the country. So that's
an ambitious goal.
It is. We may not get it into every mailbox, but we're going to get hundreds out at least. And I think the DVDs have been a fantastic tool for awakening people to the questions surrounding 9/11. And I'm hoping that that some religious folk now, you know, after some years have gone by and the emotional resistance is wearing away, we'll be ready to take a look at this again.
Well, I think that David's new book, in which he is debunking the debunkers, may help, because sort of the last word that is out with respect to the collapse of the World Trade Towers is for most people, is from Popular Mechanics. And they just assume that what they read in Popular Mechanics is more scientifically reliable than what a theologian would say.
And that's true. But then again, you know, I have to, you know, see the government is pretty much talking like the Marx Brothers here. You know, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?
That's,
you know,
right.
You watch, you know, it's sort of like, you know, if somebody, you know, just took a house and filled it full of dynamite, press the plunger, and the house just explodes with a massive boom, and stuff is blown all over the place. And then the government comes in and says, "Oh, you know that the termites really got to those beams." And everybody says, "Oh yeah," and, you know, Popular Mechanics says it was termites. It's almost that obvious. But,
well, I'm with you, but I can assure you that there are a great many people who at present, I mean, even the people I live with here in this community who are quite open-minded, they need to have an answer to Popular Mechanics.
That's right, and I'm really looking forward to David's book. Have you had a chance to look at his manuscript or anything he's done for
it
yet?
I love it, yes. I have seen some of the manuscript.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is, should be very convincing to anybody who reads it. Of course, most people haven't even read the Popular Mechanics thing. They've just heard that it explains things.
Right, right. Yeah.
That's enough. Yeah, you know, there is a technological explanation that we will not allow this.
Right.
Political flag explanation.
Right. Yeah, I'm certainly hoping that the upshot of this, you know, if and when we win this thing, will be that people will start to think for themselves again and stop trusting anonymous experts and authority figures to do their thinking for them. I'm a folklorist, and one of the things I love about folklore is taking a look at what people have to say to each other in informal channels. And often that's much more honest and in some cases more accurate than the kinds of information that gets transmitted through the customary, you know, official channels. And so I'm hoping that we can, you know, regain some of our self-confidence and ability to think for ourselves after 9/11 Truth revolutionizes our way of thinking.
And one would think that after it has become clear that the administration lied us into the Iraq war and has told many other lies along the way, too, and it wouldn't be so hard for people to believe that the administration has lied about 9/11. But in spite of all that, in spite of the fact that people know that the administration lies to them, they just can't believe it went to this extreme. The other thing people keep telling me is, but if that were really true, then we would have more people who were involved in it or who knew about it speaking out. And I try to point out that there's absolutely no incentive to speak out because you'll get in trouble yourself and the press will pay no attention to what you say and Congress will pay no attention to what you say. In other words, speaking out does not reach the people. So it must be very frustrating for some who do know about it and who would really like to share the truth, that the channel for doing that is clogged.
That's true. Well, if anybody wants to call in and share the truth here, our call-in line at rbnlive.com is 800-313-9443. So if you helped blow up the World Trade Center and really want to confess to an eminent theologian, he's not a Catholic priest, so he can't do a real confession here. What denomination are you, John?
Methodist.
Okay. If you want to confess to a Methodist theologian, one of the world's leading intellectual theologians, no less, I would think that would be enough incentive for some demolisher of conscience, wouldn't you, John?
The price is high.
Indeed, yeah. I guess after the JFK assassination, there were quite a few mysterious deaths of people who actually had inside information that could have held up in a court of law. Those are the kind of people that have to watch out. People like you and me who just are pretty much researching it or talking about it but don't have any inside information seem to have, you know, our life expectancy doesn't go down all that much.
I was really worried about David for a while, and I think he was a little worried. He avoided being on television, he said, for a while, because he thought not so much that the government would get him, but that some crackpot would be so angry at hearing what he said that his life might be threatened by that. In any case, we still have a remarkably free nation in the sense that we can say what we think, and most of us don't pay much of a price for it.
That's true, and in fact, that's one of my arguments that I've made for 9/11 Truth is that if you really want to sell, you know, freedom and democracy to the Muslim world and the Arab world, you know, instead of blowing up your own buildings and launching a war against them, and, you know, if we can expose this thing, it will be the greatest advertisement for American freedom and democracy ever produced. They will, you know, they will be amazed. I mean, my Muslim friends are amazed at the stuff I'm saying. You know, going on, you know, Bill O'Reilly and saying the things I'm saying, they just can't believe that it can be done, because in especially the immigrants in the countries they came from, it couldn't be done. I mean, you'd have your head cut off immediately. So I think the 9/11 Truth Movement is actually a pretty good argument for the viability of this country. In fact, it's about, you know, almost the only argument left.
Well, I've tried to express my pride in the country when I can. There are so many things I'm not proud of, but I have a lot of contacts these days with Chinese professors, and I had a conversation with one of them just the other day who was asking me about the book that you were asking about, the one with Griffin and Falk and Keller. And he was just trying to figure out what was going on. I mean, he couldn't imagine in China anybody writing a book about the policies of the Chinese government. That would be remotely like that, you know. Whereas that book is not even very controversial. Westminster has paid a price for publishing David's book. But in our context, we can publish things like the one we wrote together without any problem at all.
That's true, and it's I've had paid a little bit of a price, and you know, when you talked about David being worried about crazy people coming after him, I got some pretty interesting threatening emails. If you want to look at those, if you go to Mujka and look for Flowers for Algernon, I collected these hundreds of nasty emails I got from a family.
Well, you also have the state legislature coming down on
That's right. Yeah. So it's a little hairy, but certainly we still are able to speak our minds in this country better than people in many places.
And it's extremely important that we use the freedom to speak our minds.
Okay. I guess we have a caller on the line. Is it Rita in Colorado? Come in. Hello.
Oh, hi, Kevin. I was interested in what you were saying about Muslims in original sin. I was well greeted in The Hague in a Muslim community there. And are we getting the music already?
I'm not hearing it.
Okay, well,
I'm
hearing it, but if you can't hear it, then I'll just keep talking.
Well, no, I think you're going to have to come back after the break because the music is indeed playing, meaning that we are going to have to listen to a couple more wild and crazy commercials. Stay tuned.
Hey, America. We took the time, no one's to blame. My no time flies so quickly. But when I see you, darling, it's like we both are falling in love again. It'll be just like starting over.
No, it's just like starting over here with Rita, who was just beginning to tell us what was on her mind, and we got cut off. So, Rita, you're back with us. Continue, please.
It mentioned in the book Mary, when she withdrew from her family to a place toward the east, and she took in seclusion from them screen, and we sent to her our angel, and he represented himself to her as a well-proportioned man. So you were talking about original sin?
Well, I was saying that technically Muslims don't believe in it.
I met some Muslims, and there are Muslims that get along with Christians. When you look at a place like Tajikistan, it's about 20% Russian Orthodox and 75% Muslim. And the difference there is that it's Christianity, basically pre-Tridentine Christianity and Islam. Can interact, because we can understand this concept, but if we have sort of starting from a Zionist culture where 501c3 churches are forced to pretend that bisexual sodomites are equivalent to righteously ascended angel breeders, then of course there's going to be a problem.
Okay.
There are rights, you know, there are rights that are known and respected in different cultures. And, I wish I was in Bishkek.
You wish you were what?
I was in Bishkek, Tajikistan sometimes.
Okay, well, I guess in places where Islam has coexisted with so-called Eastern Christianities, for the most part, folks have gotten along fairly well, and there's even a certain amount of sort of overlap in some of the religious practices and outlooks. Do you have any comments on that, John? You're the expert.
Oh, no, I'm not the expert on what happens in countries where the Eastern Orthodox and Muslims live together, but I do have the impression that the cultural connections between them are closer than between Muslims and Western Christians.
So, Rita, you're talking about Tajikistan. What do you think about this success of the movie Borat, which sort of parodies?
didn't see the movie.
Okay, probably just as well.
Okay, but I would just like to say that, you know, when you're talking about original sin, you know, consider that that's a concept of Christianity that basically Western Christians just play lip service to. That there are Christians that understand society and customs and keep those, you know, dear to us. And so that if you're, you know, if you're going to say these things, just consider that the rest of the world is going to look at you calling yourself a Muslim or a Christian and thinking of you as Zionist.
Okay, Rita. Well, I appreciate that input, and we'll chew that over. And we do have a list of callers already, at least four people and maybe more. So we're going to have to chew through them fast when we come back after the break. So stay with us. It's Truth Jihad Radio. Evan Barrett with theologian John Cobb. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I guess we're already back here on Truth Jihad Radio once again. It's Kevin Barrett, your host, talking with theologian John Cobb, one of the world's leading theologians, in fact. And we do have a long list of callers stacked up. We better start working on that stack. And at the top of the stack is Bill from Kentucky. You're on the line, Bill. How are you doing?
Hey, guys. This is Bill Geltner calling from Kentucky. As a Muslim American, Kevin, I want to say I just love what you're doing.
You sure you're not Troy from West Virginia?
This is Bill Geltner.
Well, thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. And we're going to move on here to Jane from Maryland. How you doing, Jane? You there, Jane?
Yeah, how you going? Great show. Interesting. I was going to ask Dr. Cobb a little bit about process theology, but first I wanted to ask him if he also taught or worked many years at the Claremont Institute of Theology. Is that right, with David Ray Griffin?
Yes, that's correct.
I guess I'm curious about Claremont because I have read that on its board and one of its principal funders was Howard Amundsen, who's an extreme, Christian Reconstructionist, pretty much associated with the ideas, with Rush Dooney's ideas.
I had never heard that he gave us any money. If he did,
Well, he was actually on the board of directors of the Claremont Institute. You weren't aware of that,
Well,
huh?
Now, the Claremont Institute, I think, maybe is an entirely different organization. What I have been part of is the Claremont School of Theology.
But you have worked with Herman Daly of the World Bank and the Club of Rome,
that's
right?
That's correct, yes.
So,
but I think the Claremont Institute
is connected
with Claremont McKenna College.
Well, I want to research that a little more. Let me ask you something. What do you think about the vulnerability of, shall we say, theological or religious movements to infiltration by state intelligence agencies or their proxies? How do you feel about that milieu as a place for penetration and infiltration and manipulation to advance various covert agendas by intelligence agencies?
Well, it can certainly happen, and especially on the mission field, this had been a problem, that the CIA wanted missionaries to give them information that it was more difficult for CIA agents to get. And, of course, the churches are opposed to doing that, but nevertheless, I'm sure some of it has happened.
I think it's a little bit...
Well, thanks, Jane. I appreciate your input.
Okay.
And, indeed, you know, I've heard that the missionary activities have been a site for this sort of thing from the beginnings of colonialism. Actually, the missionaries often preceded the governments and the business interests. I guess our next caller is Renee from North Carolina. Come in, Renee.
Hello. Hello.
Okay, let's see. Earlier, y'all were discussing something to the effect of, because I don't want to get anybody's words wrong, but that a lot of these people who, when they do wrong, but they don't really understand themselves of doing wrong, as if it somehow absolves of them the fact, because they think they're being virtuous, that it's almost like okay. Now, that's kind of the impression I got. And I remember that Scott Peck, in his book People of the Lie, actually described evil as the people who are most evil are those people who do wrong, but they hide it from themselves out of conscious awareness so that they can do the evil but not suffer the pain of legitimate guilt. And that's what he, you know, and actually what Christianity often calls evil, you know, psychology calls a sociopath. In other words, so, you know, I find it really upsets me when people rationalize evil done under the pretense of doing good would not somehow be still evil. In fact, it's the worst kind of evil because it's so covert and hypocritical.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Renee, and we'll be back hearing John Cobb's answer after the break. Song a few times. It's my favorite secularist, John Lennon, proposing his utopia. It's not necessarily mine, but hey, we have room for all kinds of people on this show. This is Kevin Barrett on Truth Jihad Radio, and we were just hearing from Renee from North Carolina, who posed what I think is a pretty good question to John Cobb. Isn't by saying that people who do evil are acting understandably given their own pictures of the world, are we not in danger of excusing it?
I think that's correct, but to me, my point was that what we believe is so very, very important, and we have underestimated the importance of theology or ideology or whatever we want to call it in this country. So I'm trying to emphasize that to subject our ideas to critical study and to reflection is often the most important thing we can do in order to avoid doing evil. I think all of us are a little mixed, and none of us acts in complete innocence. And the more we can be aware of what we of the fact that we are influenced by very self-centered concerns as well as by concerns for the broader good, the better. But it's dangerous to think that that everybody who opposes us is acting out of vicious motives. I think that's relatively rare. Usually the motives are very mixed, and mine are very mixed also. So I prefer to put the emphasis on trying to understand why people act as they do, what reasons they have, how they justify it to themselves. And then the fact that they're not perfectly honest with themselves in doing it is also an important point to bring out, and then to be concerned about whether I also am not quite honest with myself when I try to explain what I'm doing. But I appreciated your point that we do sin. I do believe in original sin. I think we're all guilty of dividing the world into us and them, and of exaggerating the evils of them and exaggerating the virtues of us and distorting the context in which we make judgments in that way. So I expect that I could agree with everything you said as long as I can also make some other points.
Well, that's a good point too, John. I appreciate that. Your essay in 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, is entitled The Evil That Results from Erroneous Beliefs, and you develop that argument very well. I would personally would add that there's also a certain kind of evil that results from cognitive dissonance. That is, we know that only 16% of the American people say they believe the government's telling the truth about 9/11. And you would think that the other 84% would be rioting in the streets until they got the truth, because this is the most important historical event of the century. And yet they continue to go about their daily lives oblivious. Likewise with global warming, many people know that our planet is in danger, and yet we continue to drive around and put it even more in danger. So, I would add that there's a certain evil that results from believing something, yet having a certain state of cognitive dissonance and being in denial about it.
I think that's absolutely correct.
Okay. So I think we have some more callers. Mark from Texas should be on the line, if I'm not mistaken. Are you there, Mark?
Yes, sir, I am. How are you all tonight?
Well,
I'm sitting here watching the eulogy for President Ford. We just had Dennis Hassert speak, and now we got Dick Cheney up there, the Spiro Agnew of the Bush White House. Anyway, but I got a serious question. I'm having trouble. I think I've put my arms around what Zionism is and the Zionists. You know, it's no different than they're no more Jewish than Nelson Mandela. But what I'm having trouble with is the Messianic and the Sabbateans and the Orthodox Jews. Can you stipulate the difference between those three? Is it just a chronological difference, you know, over the ages, or are all three still alive and well, or I'm really confused on this one.
Well, I'm more confused than you are, John. How about you?
I'm not sure I can help either. I hope you're going to have a Jew on next time. And you can...
No.
But you said the Orthodox and the Sabbateans, and what was the other?
The Messianic.
Okay, well, I can say something about the Orthodox and the Messianic. These two terms can extensively overlap, but they're not completely identical. Messianic Jews are those who, at various points along the way, either are expecting the Messiah very imminently or actually believe the Messiah has come. I happened to be in Jerusalem and see a big sign up about the Messiah having come. There was a rabbi who some of his followers thought was the Messiah. So the interest in messianism is one that keeps cropping up. And, of course, there are Jews who think Jesus was the Messiah, the Jews for Jesus. So that would be a form of messianic Judaism. Orthodoxy has much more to do with practice than it does actually with teaching. Those who try to observe all of the laws carefully and think that it's crucial to do that and then to have a state which enforces those laws and so forth and so on, that would be an Orthodox form of Judaism. And some of the Orthodox Jews are messianists, and others don't take the Messiah issue that seriously. I don't know whether that helps. But
well,
the reason
I asked the question, I grew up in a very small town, and there weren't really any Jews. And I'm really, I'm not very adept to all the different religions. And this one here, it's been around for so long, and I don't know if it's been abused or... I'm really not sure yet. I'm just trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
You mean of Judaism? You mean Judaism has been around so long?
Yes, sir.
Yes, it certainly has. And both Christianity and Islam are very much derivative from Judaism. So its role in the world has been enormous, and it continues to produce extraordinarily creative people. It's a remarkable tradition. Which,
thanks for taking
my call. When you say something is remarkable and has done all those things, it doesn't mean everything it's done is wonderful. There are distortions and perversions and all kinds of evils that have come out of Judaism, just as out of Christianity, and I think out of Islam as well.
No, I think that's well put. Thanks, Mark, for asking those questions. As you know, I was the Muslim editor, John was the Christian editor, and Sandra Lubersky, a Jewish studies professor, was the Jewish editor of our joint effort, 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. And perhaps if you want to learn more about Judaism, I can have Sandra on at some point. I would like to invite other contributors to our book on in the future. As the book comes out, I think it'll be interesting to have to continue the dialogue that began as we were editing it and allow people to join in. I think we do have another caller on the line, Keenan from California. Are you there, Keenan? Hello, come in, Keenan.
Hello.
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 How are you doing?
Great. Hey, really liked the show today. Glad that John Cobb, he's made a good contribution to asking, you know, why people do what they do. And I think there's one thing that he might be missing, and that's the psychological profile. I think that, and I agree with you that denial does create evil, but an even worse evil is what comes from psychopathy. And I think that's what people really need to understand, is that 6% of the population are psychopaths. And, you know, these people gravitate to these positions of power, and the way they think is so different than normal people that's how the masses, you know, keep getting fooled and bamboozled by these people.
I think that's a pretty good point. Kurt Vonnegut came right out several years ago and said that the Bush administration is a bunch of psychopaths. I think he hit the nail on the head. It looks like Cheney seems to have an authoritarian personality and absolutely no sense of shame, and some of the others too. So, yeah, what do you think about that, John? Do we have to deal with psychopaths who are actually, you know, playing on a different field from the rest of us?
Well, I'm again hesitant to make psychological analyses because I'm not an expert in that. I do think that the whole political system is one that means it's very difficult to go to the top without having certain psychological traits. You have to be prepared to accept an enormous amount of criticism and attack. You have to really want power. And I suspect that this hunger for power is connected with other psychological traits that are not all that attractive. So whether the term psychopath is strictly applicable to a lot of the people in government, I'm sure it's applicable to some.
I know some of the military studies after World War II showed that most soldiers in the infantry didn't want to fire at the enemy, but instead would either refuse to fire. They just wouldn't fire. They'd pretend they were, or they would shoot over the enemy's heads, and that the actual killing in warfare, specifically World War II, but they did other studies on previous wars based on, you know, archaeology, showed that a small minority of the soldiers were doing most of the killing. And that, in fact, it turns out that there's sort of maybe 2% to 5%, I hope it's not 6%, of the people who would just as soon, you know, kill you as look at you. And those are the people that that do most of the killing in warfare. And one of the basic social problems is, what do we do with these people?
Yeah, one of the things that distressed me was seeing about the fact that, having discovered that only a small percentage of people were really willing to kill, the Army has now developed methods of training that have broken through those inhibitions. So a much higher percentage in the present war are willing to kill than has been true in the past.
That's right.
We are turning people into psychopaths systematically. And
that does seem like a rather bad idea. And
it's deeply disturbing.
And it's done through dehumanizing enemies, and indeed 9/11, as I see it, was an inside job designed to dehumanize Muslims and create this enemy image of Muslims to send the...
Therefore, we dehumanize ourselves in order to respond.
Absolutely. So let's rehumanize ourselves. Looks like we're in for another break, so stay with us. John, are you going to be able to stay on the line?
I'm going to have to leave at this
Okay.
point.
Yeah, so John is checking out, but you all stay with us. Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. We're playing the Mind Gorilla tonight. This is Kevin Barrett, your host. John Cobb, the eminent theologian, has had to go about his other business. He's no longer with us on the line, but I'd be happy to talk to any of you. You don't even have to be as eminent as John. All you have to do is pick up your phone and dial 1-800-313-9443. That's the call-in number here at rbnlive.com. And we can continue our discussion of basically the problem of evil, the problem of why people do bad things, the more specific problem of why neoconservatives do bad things, like blowing up the World Trade Center to usher in an era of endless war and fascism. Are they doing it just because they're evil, or are they doing it because they honestly believe that the U.S. empire is a good thing and it should go out and invade all these other countries, and in order to do that and collect the money to do that, it will have to roll back civil liberties so people will be willing to give up their tax money and go along with the program and allow their children to die in these wars. So it's a good thing, after all, if you're in the neoconservative mindset, to blow up the Twin Towers, murder 3,000 Americans, invade the rest of the world, destroy the Constitution. It's all for the greater good. That's a kind of a somewhat caricatural description of an excuse for the neocons. I think John Cobb has done a pretty good job, though, of making the argument that evil often results from erroneous beliefs. It doesn't necessarily result from any kind of inherent viciousness, although there may be some psychopaths out there who are inherently vicious, but most of the evil that's done in the world results from people having erroneous belief systems and pursuing those systems in destructive ways. It's a fascinating argument. I highly recommend that people check out his essay, which is in the new book, 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. It's now available on Amazon, and it should be shipping and arriving in the bookstore sometime in about 3 weeks. So we're going to be talking to some of the contributors to that book. This is Kevin Barrett, by the way. I'm a co-editor of that book. I was the token Muslim editor, just as I'm the token Muslim here on RBNLive.com. And John Cobb was the Christian editor. We also had a Jewish editor, Sandra Lubarsky. It was fascinating to work with John and Sandra in producing this book, in collecting these essays from a lot of the leading religious thinkers of our time, most of whom are quite suspicious of the official story of 9/11 and suspect it to be an inside job, as indeed John does, as indeed I do. And so 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, is definitely worth checking out. And John's contribution, his exploration of the problem of evil, the problem of the motivations and or belief system of the neoconservatives who drafted the PNAC proposal for a new Pearl Harbor to launch the massive American imperial expansion overseas that they desired. They called for that new Pearl Harbor in a memo or publication in September 2000, exactly 1 year before 9/11, called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And John argues that from their perspective, this makes sense. There always has to be a ruler. It might as well be us. Let's conquer the world. But the only way to do it is to fool the American people by blowing up the World Trade Center and whipping the country into a mad, psychotic war frenzy and stomping off to take over the world. And in their mindset, that could be acceptable. Well, I don't know. I think there's some room for debate on that. And if you want to debate about it, call in at 1-800-313-9443 here at rbnlive.com. I'll be happy to take you up on it. Personally, I think that we need to give up these kinds of crazy ambitions to rule the world. You know, anybody who thinks the Muslims need to conquer everybody and rule the whole world, I think they're misinterpreting Islam. I think the same thing is true for Americans who think the American empire has to rule the whole world. Basically, anybody with these kinds of mad fantasies really should confine them to the privacy of their own bedrooms. We don't really need you inflicting this on the rest of us. You know, just let me mind my own business and you go mind yours. I don't think there has to be a ruler. I would like to be the ruler of my own destiny. I don't think anybody needs to come and enforce their belief system or their way of doing things on me. I would like to be free to choose my own. Thank you very much. So I guess that's where the neoconservatives and I would differ there and in many other places. At the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, that's MUJCA.com, we are working to deprogram the religious communities by interfaith dialogue aimed at getting to the truth of 9/11 or even discussing just the facts and meaning of 9/11 if you're not ready for the truth, as so many are not. And we're working on it. We're getting there. We're outreaching. We're making connections. And I think this next year we're going to go further than we ever have. So when we come back from the break, feel free to call in, and we'll pick up where we left off. Hang in there. You're right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
What in the world are you thinking of, guys? Instant karma is going to get you, you neocons. You know, I don't know what the problem of evil really amounts to, and, you know, I don't really know, I don't presume to judge exactly how people come to act the way they do, but I think instant karma is going to get all of us one way or another. So before I start taking callers, and we do have a bunch lined up, let me just say that if you're interested in who will be coming on this show in the future, you can go to the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance website. That's MUJCA.com. And there is a radio schedule right up there at the top. Future guests will include Key Dudney, a brilliant philosopher, mathematician, writer, former columnist for Scientific American. He took over when Martin Gardner left. He'll be one of my guests. Dave Schlesinger, the civil disobedience activist. Mike Berger of 911truth.org. Barb Honegger, former member of the Bush 1 administration, who exposed the October surprise in which George Bush flew to Paris to negotiate with the Iranians and keep the hostages locked up so that Reagan would beat Carter. She's also a 9/11 researcher who's proven that bombs went off in the Pentagon several minutes before any airborne object hit. We're going to have David Griffin on the air with us. We're going to have Faz Khan, 9/11 first responder and the leading Muslim American 9/11 truth activist, and a whole lot of other really great people. I apologize to those I've missed. So go to MUJCA.com, and right up there at the top, you'll find out who is coming on the radio with me. Well, who is coming on the radio with me? I guess we have Mike from Maryland is first in line. Are you there, Mike?
Yes, thank you very much. I don't know if you remember, I saw you at the symposium at George Mason University. Sat next to you with an Italian restaurant where we went to after the meeting.
Oh, yeah. Hey, how you doing, Mike?
Pretty good.
Yeah, that was a fun meal. Webster Tarpley across the table and, you know, a bunch of cool D.C. people there, huh?
And I handed out DVDs to all the waitresses there of the
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so which is pretty cool. And I try to make a special effort to, if I know somebody is Muslim, to try to make them aware about 9/11, how it was our government and not them that was responsible. So I try to make a special effort to reach out to Muslims, because I hate to see them Muslims demonized. Even though I disagree with the Muslim religion, hey, it's a free world, free country. But I wish your guest was still on, because he seems like a very articulate and very well-spoken and interesting person. But I disagree with his thesis, and maybe ultimately your thesis too, of why we're in Iraq and other areas, you know, because it's not for an American empire, because for me the quintessential empire is ancient Rome. And like when Rome went into Gaul, they bought back slaves and had their warriors fight in the army. They bought back furs and slaves from Germany. When they went into modern-day Spain, Iberia, they bought back silver and they bought gold from Dacia. So basically, an empire, you exploit the people that you conquer, and you basically run their, you know, you take as much as you can from the conquered peoples, and you bring it back to your home country, and a great deal of wealth flooded back into Rome. The United States of America, excuse me, I should say the United States, because there's a difference between the United States and the United States of America, but that's another story. But at any rate, though, we're doing just the opposite. Our treasury is being drained. Our military is intentionally being run into the ground, and ultimately, well, basically, we stopped being a sovereign country in 1913 when foreign bankers controlled our currency. So I look upon Iraq ultimately as the template for the United States. And I don't really think that the globalists care, or the people that run our country, if the truth about 9/11 comes out, because their ultimate goal is the destruction of this country. And I think eventually they're going to set off a dozen or two nukes in this country and maybe some biologicals and kill 20, 30, or 40 million people. Let us stew in our juices for 5 or 10 years while this happens, then send in 2 or 3 million Chinese troops and hurt us all up, and then go on from there. I think that's their ultimate goal. So I don't really think they care once the 9/11 truth comes out, because their ultimate goal is that, I know this sounds rather bleak.
It sure does.
Yeah, so I really don't think they care if the truth gets out, because, you know, Iraq is the template for this country. So the United States is the rented mule that's being rode hard and hung up wet to be used as an engine to promulgate the global agenda. And we're
just, you know, Mike, I tend to agree with a lot of that. And I think the term American Empire is misleading in some ways, because it implies that, you know, every American citizen is somehow equally responsible for this. And in fact, I agree with you that there's a money power behind the scenes that is responsible for this empire. I'm not sure I agree with you, though, that it's entirely, you know, the situation we're in right now is a treasury drain. It is, of course. They're spending way more money than they're taking in, and they're destroying the dollar with these military adventures. But the point of the military adventures may well be to keep the U.S. dollar propped up. Now, the U.S. dollar is not the American dollar. It's the Federal Reserve note. The Federal Reserve, as you know, is a private consortium of bankers. But the U.S. military is being used by these bankers to prop up the U.S. dollar as the world's only oil currency. If you want to buy oil, you need to stockpile dollars. That's why 80% of the world's currency is in U.S. dollars. And the military expansion of this empire, I think, is aimed at propping up the U.S. dollar and maintaining the control of the power structure behind it, which, of course, is not the American people. It's a small number of super-rich individuals who are exploiting the American people as well as everybody else.
Well, I disagree with that in this regard, in the fact that they're doing everything within their power to diminish and to denigrate the dollar, but they want to do it, and ultimately to lead to a cashless society. And of course, I'm sure you heard about the Pan-American Union, where we unite Canada, U.S., and Mexico into one country, and they're going to have the Amero. So I think that eventually the currency is supposed to be destroyed, but they want to have a relatively soft landing in order to do so, because if it happens too quickly, it could have catastrophic consequences for the world economy. So I think that their goal is ultimately the destruction of this country and probably killing a third of our population, ultimately, with the takeover, the world takeover, because once they destroy our military and our economy, then they'll just, that's why they're building up China, then China's going to be the enforcer here.
Well, that's always possible. I think the global power elite doesn't have much of a loyalty to any particular country. And so I would agree with you there, and I would agree with you that what we're calling the American Empire, for lack of a better term, is in fact a power structure that's not being controlled by the American people, but is being controlled by these people who have no loyalty to the U.S. In fact, it's interesting that you bring this up, because in the book that John Cobb and I co-edited, there's an essay by Dr. Faz Khan, who will be my guest in the future, inshallah, as we say, and Faz got himself into hot water a little bit with some of our the editorial board, not me so much, because he agrees pretty much with you. He doesn't see it as American empire. He really emphasizes that this is the empire of international finance, the banker's empire.
And the United Nations as well. We're just not wearing the blue helmets, that's all.
Right. And I think that's a legitimate perspective. I haven't done enough research to be certain that some of these more extreme-sounding projections that you're bringing forth are well supported by evidence. But I think your basic point that this American empire is not the American people; it's the financial power behind the scenes, people who are globalists, who are pursuing their power designs and may very well end up weakening and destroying all of our national institutions here. I think that's a point that's well taken.
Because it's the same thing with Serbia, too, because we use American might to destroy Serbia so the central bankers could take over. As a matter of fact, just after the invasion of Iraq, a journalist on Fox News says, you know, made the mistake of telling the truth. He said, and now the central bankers can control the Iraqi economy. So, you know.
Right. Well, sometimes a little truth does leak out over Fox News. I certainly tried to make some leak out when I was on there. Didn't have a lot of time to do it. Yeah, well, thanks. I appreciate those points, Mike, and it's good to hear from you again. And I think I'd better move on because we do have a stack of callers and a little time left. Our next caller is Keith from Indiana. Are you there, Keith?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. How are you doing?
Oh, not bad. I tried to call in when your guest was on because I think he was wholly off base. I mean, I'll tell you, these guys with the degrees after their names, all the letters, seems like the further they get away from the truth of God. I'm a Christian. I believe the Bible. I understand you're not. Just tuned into your show tonight for the first time.
That's right. I'm a lapsed Unitarian, and I lapsed into Islam.
Well, he made the statement that the Muslim faith, Islam, and Christianity are basically offshoots of Judaism. And boy, is that a lie from the pit of hell. And that came through all the dispensational theology that's taken over the American churches in the last 200 years. First of all, Christ railed against the oral tradition. Judaism is based on those oral traditions. They worship the Babylonian Talmud, which I believe is the most evil and vile book, and it is genocidal. And they do blaspheming Christ all the way through it. Second of all, every single Methodist church I see has a Mason building right next to it. Well, there's another thing about him, but, you know, I mean, you know, when Christ came, he didn't go to the seminaries of his day and the intellectuals and the learned. He went to ignorant fishermen who had a heart for truth. That man's very, very badly deceived. And I'll just tell you, friend, and I'll warn you, if you're an Israelite and you're practicing the wrong faith and not following Christ, you'll have all eternity to regret it. But if you're not an Israelite, then it doesn't pertain to you. An exclusive religion to the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The covenant did not go to Ishmael, and the covenant did not go to Esau.
Well, thanks, Keith. I appreciate that input, I'm, you know, interested in hearing your perspective. I agree with you that the ordinary people often know more in their hearts than the so-called learned do in their brains. And as far as these specific issues that you're raising, I guess I don't know enough about them to get into an argument with you. As a lapsed Unitarian who lapsed into Islam, I would, you know, say that the spiritual ancestry of Islam does go through Ishmael, and in fact today is the biggest holiday on the Muslim calendar, the feast of Eid, where we celebrate God's sparing the son of Abraham, and that put an end to human sacrifice, or at least it should have. And so we have a big feast to celebrate, and we pardon our enemies, and we try to be merciful and compassionate, and so on and so forth. So to me, that's what the whole lineage through Ishmael and Abraham means. I guess we have more callers on the line here. I think John is calling from California. Come in, John.
Yeah, how you doing there, Professor Barrett?
Oh, pretty good, although I'm not a professor anymore. Actually, I never was. But,
oh, no.
But you can call me one if you want to. It sounds kind of cool.
Are you no longer associated with the University of Wisconsin?
Well, yeah. See, the thing is that I apply for semester-by-semester positions.
Oh, okay.
Because,
okay.
Yeah, see, I didn't want to move away from Wisconsin. I like it here, so I just, you know, apply for new jobs whenever I want one, and I'll hopefully be applying again in the fall, but I never plan to apply in the spring.
That, so. That's real fine, Doc. I want to thank you for lending your academic and credibility and your high visibility to this 911 movement. It was a real shot in the arm when it was needed. And I'll say a prayer to my Christian God that you maintain your employment status over at University of Wisconsin.
Well, thanks, and I'll pray to Allah that you keep your job, too.
And I need all the prayers I can get, Doc.
I guess we all do these days, don't we?
That's a fact. Hey, Doc, one thing, I'm really glad that you You gave this guy Troy from West Virginia exactly the amount of time he deserved.
You're getting tired of him too.
Oh well, I mean, he calls in at RBN Live, and I think too many people just bend over backwards to they think they're going to convert him or something. I've heard him on, you know, the Alex Jones show on that other network, and and he does the same thing, you know, and it's just disgusting. So thanks a lot for doing that. And the one thing I wanted to really talk to you about, if I could, just for a few seconds, and I know you're an aficionado of global warming, and to be perfectly honest with you, I'm on the opposite side of that. I'm a skeptic. And,
yeah, well, that's okay. I mean, we should debate that and try and produce evidence, and I don't claim to be enough of an expert to really convince you, so let me hear your side.
Well, look, here's the key thing. I've got two engineering degrees. I don't have a PhD in climatology or environmental science, but I don't think I have to read materials as they're written and to try to read both sides of the story. But to get right to the point, what I see here happening is that, and I heard this also on the previous show, on Webster Tarpley's show, he had two gentlemen on as guests, and they were going on about how they were going to talk to Congress about global warming. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you know, why don't you go and talk to the congressman about getting rid of the 20,000 gun laws and that are in this that the National Rifle Association has allowed to crop up in the last 10 or 15 years, and you know, I think a lot of people could get behind that. You know, why don't you go and talk to the congressman about real measurable damage done by illegal immigration, which I don't hear anyone in the 911 movement talking about. You know, but
there actually are a few. And,
no, you're right. There are a few. But
sure, you like Michael Wolfe of Colorado 9/11 Visibility.
Sure.
I think it is. He's talked about that, and he's taken a lot of bad reactions from certain people who don't like that.
But you know what I mean, Doc. You know what I mean. It's not uppermost on things that I hear you talking about, or Webster Tarpley talking about, or the other leaders who are going to be down in Washington D.C. or in these other movements. But instead, what I do hear people talking about is global warming. And the one thing I keep wondering, you know, I keep coming to on the whole issue of global warming is, I've been going to energy efficiency conferences out here in Southern California for the last 4 or 5 years. And, boy, every time I hear a lot, you know, about saving energy so that we can reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and cut down on global warming and how that's supposed to be some kind of tangible benefit. But the one thing that really bugs me about your side of the story, with all due respect, sir, is the lie, this big lie that there's a general scientific consensus. And I'm having a real lot of trouble with that, especially in view of the Heidelberg Petition, which has been around since 1998. And at present has over 17,000 signatures from signatories who are climatologists, who at least have a Master of Science degree and who are working on numerical methods in the development of global circulation models.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, and that's at the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, OISM.org website, you know, I'm having a lot of trouble understanding how anyone can tell me with a straight face that there's general scientific consensus in view of that simple, unalterable fact.
You know, that's a good point in that I don't know just how strong this consensus is. To my knowledge, it looks pretty strong. When we come back after the break, I can tell you what little I know about this.
Will you hold it or what? Or you want to get other callers in?
Well, good question. You know, we probably better move on. We have at least two people waiting. I'll try to address that briefly, and hopefully you can email me at muchka.com to find out more. Here we are, back at the same moment in our show when the kids on the phone never leave me alone, and they still aren't leaving me alone. We still have a lot of people on the phone. I was speaking with John from California, and he's a skeptic on global warming, and I welcome skepticism. I have no problem with that. My brief answer, what I know about it, is that very little bit that you can find out just by watching that Al Gore movie. It does seem that there's a pretty close correlation between carbon levels in the atmosphere and global temperature, and what little I've read about the long-term prognosis of our atmosphere suggests that we're already, even without the human contribution, we were in a hot period before, and that hot period is the unstable phase of our climate's fluctuation between ice ages and interglacials. And so we're already, like, a planet already has a fever, and blasting the atmosphere full of carbon, putting it up to a level where it just hasn't ever been before, seems to me to be an unwise experiment. In any case, we do have more people on the line. Super Bowl Steve is calling from Pennsylvania. Are you still with us, Steve?
Yes, I am, and I'd like to say that God will not be mocked.
That what? God will not be mocked?
Will not be mocked.
Okay. Can you be more specific?
Yes, I can be. I looked in the organization a few times, and you got problems.
No, thank you. Such as?
I can't be specific.
You can't?
No, I can't.
Well, how am I going to solve my problems if you can't tell me what they are, Steve?
Well, what I suggest you do is we get on here together, or you call me, or we get together and talk about this, because, you know, God will not be mocked, and you are mocking God, and your organization is mocking God, okay? What America's turning into is a police state.
Well, I agree with that.
Okay. I mean, who sells the milk to the people that live in the prison? Who sells the bread that live in the prison? Who sells all these things that the prison needs? And it can be sold off. Just like I live in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Turnpike is being sold for $15 billion.
Well, you know, Steve, I think that's you have some interesting things to say. You should call back next week or in a future show when we have time to talk about all this, and then maybe we can figure out what my problems are and you can help me solve them. For now, we're going to move on to Marianne in Arkansas. You with us, Marianne?
Yes, I am, Dr. Barrett. I appreciate so very much your program tonight.
Thanks.
You've had some excellent callers. Each one I want to say a comment, and then now I've got five or six people. You know, there's so much to be done. There's so much to know. First of all, you did have a caller that asked about the Jewish situation and the various things. I've absolutely refused to even read emails when it has to do with Zionism and Jewish, because it's a deep, deep subject, and people can't, you know, a lot of people, I think, are speaking out without really understanding. Can you help me over?
Well, unfortunately, I think this might be it.
Okay.
It sounds like we got the truth music coming on.
Okay, well, let me end with this. The heart of the king is in the hand of God to turn his water. We all need to be praying for our nation, and we all need to be networking, and RBN is the place to do that.
That's right, RBNLive.com. Stay with us here, the voice of free speech, and Mujkanet, MUJCA.com. The Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance is another place to network. Those of us who want to work together and try and save the world should network. And Mujka is a place to do it, and so is RBNLive.com. Thanks for being with us, folks. We've had a good one tonight. Apologize to Eric for not getting to him. Call back again next week, Eric. And everybody else, have yourself a really great new year. And I'll talk to you again in 2007. Take care.